I think as we look at these fragments that comprise the Voice of the Silence, and remember they are fragments, we may wonder at the sequence of ideas that are presented to us. But I think if we really go beneath the surface, we begin to see a pattern emerging, a pattern I think that is, oh, I'm sorry, I'm supposed to have this on. Oh, well, good.
All right. Maybe I don't need this on. I don't know where to put it anyway.
It is better.
It is better with it on. Okay. I better put it on. Forget about these things. Well, I'll start again then. As we are going through these fragments that comprise the voice, and remember, there are three specific sections which are called fragments. I think we sometimes become puzzled at the sequence of the ideas, but if we really meditate upon them, I think we see a pattern emerging, a pattern that is based on a very essential truth, in my view at least, an essential truth in occultism, and that is that only as we take each step do we become aware of the next step. It's as though further steps are somewhat in the mist or in the clouds and become clear only as we take one step at a time. But in a deeper sense, and I think this is what finally comes to emerge, there is not so much a sequence as a simultaneity of realization, which is all one can put it, the only way one can put it. One comes into a kind of interior realization. A speech, of course, itself is sequential. One word follows another. And so there is that sequentiality in it. And it's not easy to shift the words about, for then the sentence becomes meaningless. Well, on Wednesday, we considered then the bird of life. Bestride the bird of life, if thou wouldst know. And it's there in the central position between the wings that we find repose. And it's in that condition of some stability, and I referred, you recall, to Arjuna's statement in the very outset of the Bhagavad Gita, take me to the center, where he could view the entire field. I think it's an absolutely marvelous statement, and we often overlook it in our study of the Gita, that it's only there that we can take stock of our present situation, our present condition. The great Buddhist reformer to whom HPB refers frequently, Tsongkhapa, posited that the very first step is indeed to confront one's present condition. Not, you know, not just today, whatever date it is, April 7th, 1989, but at this very moment, what is one's present condition of mind, thought, of feeling, and so on? What is one's present condition? And therefore recognize the work that has to be done. And in such a state of inner reflection, of genuine inner reflection, I think we begin to recognize our fundamental ignorance, our basic non-knowing. So it's to realize or to know that we do not know, and that is our present existential condition, so to speak, that we do not know. So now we are told, therefore, of three halls through which we must pass, which correlate, I think, with three states of consciousness. But we have to be very careful in making such a correlation. I'd like to refer, therefore, to an article which HPB wrote in the very first issue of her journal, The Theosophist, in October 1879. she wrote an article, What is Theosophy? I think it's interesting that this appeared in her first issue of her journal, and members and non-members alike for the past 100 and so years have still struggled with that question, what is theosophy? And as we know, there's no official definition in the Theosophical Society. It has never been given in the rules of the society, in the statements of the General Council, the governing body, or anything else. There is no official definition that everyone has to adhere to. And yet HPB, of course, set forth certain broad aspects to answer it, and referred particularly to Plotinus, the great Neoplatonist, the pupil of the god taught, as he was known, Ammonius. Ammonius Saccas, who of course used the term, the eclectic theosophical school, as we know. And she refers to Plotinus, who, she says, tells us that the secret gnosis, or the knowledge of theosophy, has three degrees: opinion, science, and illumination. And these, she says, are the three stages in the awakening of man. I refer to this because I think it has to do with these three halls. Plotinus very clearly setting forth, therefore, and she, by implication, saying that this is theosophy, the secret gnosis, or the knowledge of theosophy, has three degrees. The first, Plotinus, she translates Plotinus as opinion, based on sense perception. This is, of course, the hall of ignorance, of avidya, of non-knowing. Dr. Taimni, for example, in his commentary on the Shiva Sutra, the ultimate reality and realization, Dr. Taimni points out that in the sutras, the state of aviveka, or non-discrimination, characterizes ordinary human life and can be compared to the Sushupti state of consciousness. As Dr. Taimni puts it, we live our whole life completely unaware of our real nature, even though we may think and be convinced that we are essentially divine in nature. Now, I think there is a difference here when we say the first hall. She calls the first hall the hall of ignorance. It's not simply the ignorant, can I put it? To be paradoxical, it's not simply the ignorance of the ignorant. I'll let you that sink in for a moment. It's the ignorance of those who begin to think they know. And there's a subtle distinction. It's becoming aware that one doesn't know. So that's why I say it's not simply the ignorance of the ignorant, but it's the ignorance of those who begin to catch a glimpse and think, aha, I know, of course, I'm divine, but I don't really know it. I am really ignorant of it. So it's because I have been told this, not because I know it. I've been told this. And so I have read the scriptures, I have read books, I have, you know, I accept the theosophical worldview, all of this, but I don't really know it. And it's that kind, to me at least. Now, some of you may not agree, and that's fine. We can discuss this point. But it's the ignorance, in other words, which arises out of opinion, as Plotinus calls it, based on sense perception, so that one has not come to yet knowing. One knows that one does not know. One begins to think, well, I know a little bit. I think often, if I can put it this way, when we come to theosophy, we get so excited, don't we? We get terribly, terribly excited. This at last is it. sort of thing. And hooray, I feel now I've got a hold of something, makes sense, it's an integrated philosophy, it's all there. And we, you know, maybe in our enthusiasm, particularly youthful enthusiasm, we want to go out and convert everybody to it. And why doesn't everyone accept it? We want to shout it from the rooftops and so on. Why doesn't everyone accept this philosophy and so on? And personally, I shudder to think of what some of my early lectures must have been like, when, of course, I was convinced that I knew everything and felt that I could go out and you know, tell the rest of the world, and because I was shoved out of the nest rather early in my theosophical career. Obviously, there weren't any other lecturers in the field. It was in the early days of the war years, and I guess something was better than nothing to be out in the field, and so there I was sent out, and absolutely convinced that I had all the answers because theosophy had all the answers and I had been reading the books. And so out I went and was a great propagandist, I suppose, and probably turned off as many people as I ever turned on. But in any event, you know, then as you go on, you realize you don't really know. You really have not made it your own. And I think this is the hall of ignorance. So that's why I say it's not the ignorance of the ignorant, but the ignorance of those who have glimpsed a little and begin to ultimately know that they don't know. So then we move, of course, into, because we recognize that we really don't know what we think we know, that we don't know very much at all, we move into the second hall, the hall of learning. This is, in Plotinus' terms, as H.P.B. gives them in her article, science, which utilizes dialectics or reason, the hall of learning. And as Light on the Path, of course, so clearly points out, we therefore have to put ourselves into a condition in which learning becomes possible. And I think learning becomes possible only when we know that we don't know. If we think we know, or if we're ignorant of any knowing, obviously we're not in a condition in which learning becomes possible, are we? So we have to bring ourselves into a condition in which learning can become possible. And this, I think, actually may be compared with the svapna state of consciousness in the Hindu philosophy, if we utilize the commentary given by Dr. Taimni on the Shiva Sutra. Dr. Taimni says, the svapna or dream state of consciousness comprises, in its widest philosophical sense, all knowledge present in the mind when the subjective self is engaged in mental activity in isolation from the objective world around him. And Dr. Taimni continues, the word svapna stands for all activity of the mind in which it is not in contact with the world outside through the sense organs, or which does not depend upon such contact. The characteristic feature of the svapna state is the absence of contact or dependence upon the external world for the mental activity in which the individual is engaged. Now that seems very complicated perhaps, but in other words, I'm equating these more or less, one has to be very careful of correlations, but more or less with the susupta state, the svapna, and hence state of jagrat, which we'll come to in a moment. These are the terms in Hindu philosophy, and I'm correlating them because Dr. Taimni seems to do so. In this, the first, it's dealing with sense perceptions. We look and what is the sense perception? and we think we base our knowledge, which is really ignorance. In the second, which is comparable, is called the dream state, we are dealing now not with the outside, but with the images which we have now presented to us. Perhaps I can, because I want later to refer to this book and recommend it very much when we come to the sounds, the book by Joachim Ernst Behrendt, B-E-R-E-N-D-T, called Nada Brahma. This is available in the bookstore. Nada Brahma, The World is Sound, Music and the Landscape of Consciousness. And I think that it's really one of the standing books that has come out recently. I have a paperback which was published in London. It's only available, it was just published last year, translated from the German was published in 1983. In this country, it's available only in hardback, I'm sorry to tell you. And that's what they have in the bookstore. The paperback doesn't seem to be available in the United States as yet. But let me just point up a statement that Behrendt makes. The seeing person analyzes, takes things apart. No longer do we see the world, we see its images. And unbelievably enough, we are content with that, content with looking at moving pictures. Living almost exclusively through the eyes has led us to almost not living at all. And this is this state in which we're in the hall of learning, we're in a condition of learning, but we are now dealing, therefore, with rationality, with the, HPB points up in her article dealing with the three degrees of Plotinus, science utilizes dialectics or reason. And so we do a great deal of reasoning, logic, and so on. And we think we are dealing with realities when we're dealing with the images. There's an interesting work also, I didn't bring the reference, so I can't give the exact reference, but in which we, which it's pointed out, the authors point out that for the most part, we deal with words, thinking the word is the thing, thinking if we know the word. For example, if we apply this to the theosophical world view, we talk about planetary chains, globes, rounds, all of that, as though the word were the reality, when we really don't really know very much about what we're talking about in talking about, say, the planetary chains. So we make diagrams, and then we say the diagram is the way it is. And of course, the diagram, the model, is not the way it is at all. But we become fascinated by the models that we create. We do this with what we call the planes of nature, or the principles of man, and so on. And so we have a diagram, or we have a model, and we learn through this, but we mistake the learning for the reality. So hence, in this hall of learning, as the voice of the silence points out, one can get into a great deal of trouble. Can mistake what is going on. In it thy soul will find the blossoms of life, but under every flower a serpent coiled. A marvelous statement. And there is that's number 26. Yes, the name of hall the second is the hall of learning. In it thy soul will find the blossoms of life, but under every flower a serpent coiled. That's verse 26. And therefore, in verse 33, having learned thine own anjana, that is non-knowing, flee from the hall of learning. This hall is dangerous in its perfidious beauty, is needed but for thy probation. Beware, Lanu, lest dazzled by elusive radiance, thy soul should linger and be caught in its deceptive light. That's verse 33. It's a marvelous statement. Dangerous in its perfidious beauty. Beware, lest dazzled by elusive radiance, thy soul should linger and be caught in its deceptive light. Now, not only is this referring then to the psychic realm of illusion, of this reflected radiance, the astral light, but also to the fact, I think, that we so often mistake the word for the reality, or our model for the reality.
What is the reality we're supposed to get from this material? I mean, for me anyway, much of the reality is a struggle with it.
It is. I think if we could define the reality, we would again be putting it into words, wouldn't we?
But it's out of our experiential reality.
That's right.
So when we get the esoteric understanding of it, what is it that we really have? Do we have just the sense of scale,
This is difficult. Let's go on a moment. Let's hold your question just a moment, because it's a very legitimate question, Lowell, and one that we can well explore. But let's hold it for just a moment and then come back to it. The third hall, of course, she calls the Hall of Wisdom, you see. And in verse 27, the name of the third hall is Wisdom, beyond which stretch the shoreless waters of Akshara, the indestructible fount of omniscience, all-knowing. In verse 32, seek for him who is to give thee birth in the hall of wisdom, the hall which lies beyond, wherein all shadows are unknown, and where the light of truth shines with unfading glory, and so on. Marvelous, you see. Now, this, I think, corresponds, I'm still keeping your question, Lowell, for a moment. This, it seems to me, corresponds to that third aspect, which Plotinus calls illumination, which arises from intuition, as HBB says, founded on the identification of the mind with the object known. So there's no longer the word that intervenes, there's no longer the model or diagram or whatever, but the actual identification. Here we have entered the Hall of Wisdom, and I suggest that we can compare this to the Jagrat state. Again, to quote the Shiva Sutra, the Jagrat, or waking state of consciousness, comprises in its widest sense all knowledge when the subjective self is in direct contact with the objective world around him on any plane. Jagrat, of course, is considered the waking state only on the physical plane, but I think we have to see that it's a state of consciousness characteristic of wakefulness on any plane throughout the entire manifested universe. As Dr. Timely points out, and I'd like to read Dr. Timely's concept, his view, the consciousness radiating from the atmic center through all the planes of manifestation not only provides the radiating and illuminating power to the mind working on any plane, but also imparts significance to what is present in the mind in the form of knowledge. And the fact that we can compare, therefore, the Hall of Wisdom to the Jagrat state is further corroborated in another passage, another verse in the Shiva Sutras. The Jagrat, or waking state of consciousness in an individual at all levels, is the secondary effulgence of the supreme light of consciousness of Shiva, the primary effulgence being the divine consciousness of the Logos. Marvelous statement. This is in chapter 3, verse 8 of the Shiva Sutras, and I recommend that Dr. Timney's translation, The Ultimate Reality and Self-Realization, and to ponder upon this. So in this sense, you see, coming back to your question, Lowell, when there is that waking state of consciousness at all levels throughout the universe, is the secondary, he calls it, or the Shiva Sutra calls it, effulgence of the supreme light of consciousness. So words cease. The experience is all that is there. And this, in a sense, coming back to what Behrendt says, the ears, on the other hand, having talked about the eye, we see now the world. This is the hall of learning. We see its images. To put it provocatively, the highest, most admirable ideal of the eye person is to possess an eagle eye. The eagle spots its prey, dives, and seizes it. This is a fitting ideal for a Western man who has become accustomed to looking at the entire world as his potential prey. It is a beautiful ideal, but an aggressive one. And in today's world, that means a dangerous one. The ears, on the other hand, are symbolized by a muscle or a conch, which in turn symbolize the female sex organ, itself a symbol for receiving and engulfing, for becoming one. To the ancient Chinese, the eyes constituted a yang type of sense organ, male, aggressive, dominating, rational, surface-oriented, analyzing things. The ears, on the other hand, are a yin sense, female, receptive, careful, intuitive, and spiritual, depth-oriented, perceiving the whole as one. And this is perhaps why the voice of the silence, sound, becomes then very, very significant. Hear, seeing, hear, listening. Use of the ears, listening, which is to take in, to make whole. And so in this sense, you see, how it becomes an experience which is non-communicable. It's the true mystic experience, probably, in which muo, of course, means to close the mouth or lips. The mystic, of course, was the one in the Greek mysteries who was reborn into eternity, wasn't he? He was initiated into that realm. And therefore, it was often said it was unlawful to speak about it. And I suggest not so much unlawful as the very fact he couldn't speak about it. The mystic never can fully convey his experience, can he? So does that begin to answer your question, Flo?
I think I understand it. One integrates into himself a set of correspondences mm-hmm. that carries across all scales.
Yes, I think so. So it's one's presence, then, that communicates. Because one can never say, you see. One can, but it's that's why I think HPB introduces us to these three halls at this point. In a sense, I think it's that we must be awake even when we are asleep. And it's said of the Buddha that he was awake even when he was asleep.
That brings to mind the conventional way of Jagrat Svapna. Mm-hmm. There was another state.
Yes, the fourth.
Mm-hmm. The fourth state beyond. Mm-hmm. But that would be related to this pattern of sleep and going into beyond the deep sleep where there's
mm-hmm.
no dreaming.
Yes.
I don't suppose that enough quite in this way you're using it.
Yes, you see, there is always the fourth state, which is turiya, which simply means fourth. You see, these terms are translatable, but turiya is simply fourth. That's all it is, isn't that right, Rajapan?
Turiya is the last state where you
yes.
above all these, you get out of this world altogether.
But turiya in itself simply means fourth.
Yeah, right.
Just fourth, because it can't be defined in any other way. It's a state of of conversion now into being the Buddha, so to speak, to being fully enlightened, awake.
How do you make your first step? I'll assume I'm in the Hall of Ignorance, but how do I make a positive step to the Hall of Learning? Do you use will, or do you have to have a certain amount of knowledge at that point, or is it what's the urge to move from one to the other?
I think it, to me at least, and this is what the voice of the silence is saying to us, is that one brings oneself through dharana, through meditation, through concentration, into a state of quiet in which learning now becomes possible. A new kind of learning becomes possible. No longer just external learning. No longer just taking in all the sense perceptions, which is also reading and studying and so on. One continues that, of course. One does not, suddenly close one's eyes to the world. But one now is interiorly receptive. And I think that comes through.
Receptive is where you are, want to learn.
Well, learning becomes possible. If we are already so filled, if the mind is so filled with all kinds of facts and knowledge and so on, if we are so, and immediately rush to something, then we're not in a condition of learning. I think it's, perhaps one can compare it to, a state where we say, well, I already know that, and therefore we're not open to anyone telling us a new way of doing something even, because I already know how to do that. And we immediately close ourselves off, don't we, when we say that.
Perhaps if you thought of it from an avidya state, we sort of accept, we're aware of something, but we don't look out the implications, work out what could happen if the connectedness is changed. Mm-hmm. Maybe when you start saying, yeah, that's right, but what? What would happen if?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that's this transition into the learning state. You try to see the implications of what you accept from why you reject something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can get rid of a lot of buts that way. I can see that there's something that feels like you know it, but you don't quite, you know it enough not to be serious about it, whatever it is.
Well, I think one can also think of some of the very great scientists of our time. Think about a person like Einstein, for example, who was rather dull at school, and he was a clerk in the patent office in Zurich and so on. But there was something that suddenly gave him a new way of looking at the major questions that physics was asking. And therefore, because he was not so trained in, so set in the customary way of solving problems in physics, he was able to make a breakthrough that was absolutely tremendous. I think often if one, realizes that great creative geniuses have not so much followed some kind of pattern, but have suddenly seen a twist, a new way of looking at something. And they were in a condition in which learning therefore became possible. And I think it's something happens. If we're so full, and I think our minds, if I ask you, for example, to list the principles of man, well, you all, are going to list them. It's always interesting to me because I've done this little experiment, and usually we come up with about 30 different principles, and yet everyone will agree there are only 7. But by the time you've listed everything that everyone has said, you probably have, about 30 of them. And so where do we go? Because we're all sure that we know what the 7 principles are. So we're so sure we know that it never occurs to us to stand back and say, well, maybe I don't know at all. I know some words. I have words to put to them, and I prefer this word to that word. I don't like the Sanskrit, so I'm going to put it into English, or I don't think it's good in English, so I'm going to put it into the Sanskrit. This is the way it's given, and so on. But then there's nothing new that happens to us. We're not in a condition of learning, because we're already so convinced we know.
The two things that come to mind to you, first is that we need to be childlike in our belief.
That's right.
And the second, I'd just like to share with you an interesting concept. In trying to understand what it was like for some children, I was attempting to teach, to play the violin. I endeavored to do it with the wrong hands. So I became a complete beginner, and that was a very relieving experience.
Uh-huh.
And I think that if we could in some way do this in our intellectual lives, turn things around so that it comes from the opposite direction,
uh-huh,
we might be quite stagnant.
That's a wonderful example, Jocelyn, yes, to turn things around. I think this is true. The state of learning is the childlike state, the genuinely childlike state. Supposing you had never seen a cat. And you haven't seen, yes. They're still waiting to see a gopher. If anybody finds a gopher for Murray and Jocelyn to see, please, but don't bring it here. I mean, really, we have enough here already.
Dorian, there's a key there too in the childlike school. She was teaching children, that's because she was thinking of them. The two paths don't have to be way beyond at a certain point. They're every step of the way. And you weren't seeing a need when you were a young student because they needed a lecturer. The learning step was made when you went into reading the avidya state,
mm-hmm,
because the first step is along the path is to think of others. And
yes,
you empty your own vessel of your foolish notions, then it can be filled, but it's not because you're holding the cup up to the gods.
No.
It's that you are offering, seeing the suffering of the world, and you see the need,
mm-hmm,
as you saw the need for lectures.
Mm-hmm.
And even a person who doesn't know the whole teaching will always find some person who,
mm-hmm,
wants to,
mm-hmm,
because of all of the various stages.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Wants assistance.
Wants assistance, yes. I think that's a very good point.
It sounds like you're saying you must change your habits to know. Is that what it boils down to?
Question your assumptions.
Question your assumptions. I think that's a good point, Nicholas. I think, yes. Brenda?
I have a question. I get the feeling that I need all three halls, that I'm not going to pass through, mm-hmm, the ignorance and learning hall and get to the wisdom and stay in the hall of wisdom. Mm-hmm. I have a feeling that the three of them are all important. Do you
have... You've touched on something that I think is very, very true. To me, it is very true. That actually, just as in the Mahayana tradition, Nagarjuna could say that samsara is nirvana and nirvana is samsara, between the two there is no difference. So when one really is in that, let us say, the hall of wisdom, when there is an illumination, and it's an interesting term because often we say the light came on, that it's also the hall of both learning and ignorance, that there is only one hall in which at our stage we see three separate divisions, but in which there really is no division.
The other thing I'd like to say, I don't know if this is connected to you and what you're saying now, but there are still people who haven't, who do think that there are still people who haven't reached the hall of wisdom at all, that they're at the level of ignorance and they're at the level of learning and that they haven't reached the third one. So that even though eventually all three would be linked. At some point, you might still be.
I think this is difficult to say. I mean, I don't like to, you see, I think one of the points that has to be made is that there's a non-judgmental attitude towards people. To say that X is in the hall of ignorance and Y is in the hall of wisdom is judgmental. The very fact, and I think that what's pointed to is that every individual is Buddha. He is already Buddha. And as in one of the scriptures, if you are already Buddha, why do you not act like Buddha? You know, is a legitimate question. But I would not want to be judgmental.
I like your image of walking through the path in the mist, mm-hmm. where every stepping stone is revealed as you get to it.
Mm-hmm.
In that respect, at least I, mm-hmm. from what I'm getting today, that the stepping stone just ahead of us is avidya,
mm-hmm.
and then the one we're maybe leaving, or one we just left, maybe learning, and the one we get truly integrated, maybe wisdom. So mm-hmm. we're constantly, every initiation is taking on avidya,
mm-hmm.
and just mm-hmm. the progression of that.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I would. That I would agree with. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Right. I think too we can be altered by life. A moment of the wisdom consciousness, perhaps. Mm-hmm. National illumination, which is a great encouragement thing, to trip the path from it into another.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe this corresponds to what Ben was saying.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Maybe we jump around a little bit between the states as we have been going forward.
That's it. This is a progression
mm-hmm.
from which there is no going back.
No, no.
It's a continuous churning, as far mm-hmm. as I see it,
yeah.
because you never ever leave ignorance behind. Mm-hmm.
No. Mm-hmm. There are always the shadows.
I think I'm more interested in the hall of learning because...
Well, I suspect that's where most of us are. I mean, we're in a condition... I don't think we would be here if we weren't in a condition of learning. You know, or at least questioning. And I think this is, as Nicholas said, question our assumptions, but also the condition of probing, the condition of inquiring, to inquire. And I think of those marvelous statements in Light on the Path, inquire of this, inquire of that, inquire of everything, to constantly inquire and constantly probe. And that, I think, is this condition of learning.
The childlike state.
It's the childlike state, so that one is all the time inquiring, probing, seeking. And I don't think any of us would be here in a theosophical setting if we were not probing, inquiring, learning in that state. But I think sometimes we may get to a point where we say, well, that I know, and we sort of no longer question the assumption. And perhaps there has to be that continuous question all the way through.
But we have to translate this not just in our metaphysical thinking, but to everything we do.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. Bill?
You mentioned the breakthrough in the current issue of the American Theosophist. There is a series of articles wondering why, after all these years, the Theosophical Society is still so small. Perhaps we need somebody to make a breakthrough on how to alleviate that condition.
Well, that takes us into quite another field, and I don't want to touch on that. It's because I think what we're concerned with here is the probing and inquiring into our own natures, not into external conditions, but the genuine learning, it seems to me, is when we now really inquire and probe and seek to know, because that's what we're dealing with, the voice of the silence. And it's only in that condition, it seems to me, only in that real condition of learning that we begin to hear, to really listen, no longer using the eye. And I thought this is where Berendt, I thought, struck it very well. The seeing person analyzes, takes things apart. It becomes immediately clear when seeing is taken to its extreme, looking through an electron microscope. There, even those things that seem indivisible are taken apart. The eyes are wonderful organs, but the better they are, the sharper they are. Sharpness is a quality of knives and of cutting, which for the new consciousness means a negative, destructive, possibly even murderous quality. For prehistoric people, the symbol of the eye was the arrow. The arrow, however, is capable not only of hitting its target, but also of killing. And so the thing that I thought was so interesting is that here we are focused now, the voice of the silence comes back to this, the hearing. And he goes on that the deterioration of our sense of hearing has run remarkably parallel with the process of secularization. Wherever God revealed himself to human beings, he was heard. He may have appeared as a light, but in order to be understood, his voice had to be heard. And God spoke is a standard sentence in all holy scriptures. The ears are the gateway. And so he suggests the new man will be listening man, or will never be at all. It's an interesting suggestion. To continue then, I call your attention to verses 82 and 83 in the first part. Unless thou hearest, thou canst not see. Unless thou seest, thou canst not hear. To hear and see, this is the second stage. So the emphasis again and again is on really hearing the voice of the silence. Perhaps we can point out that the chief characteristic of what I often call the fundamental fiber of our being, which is the fundamental fiber of the universe, if you like, alaya or akasha, mystically, is sound. And we're all familiar with the concept that sound creates, that it has a tremendous potency, and so on. Berendt's work, Nada Brahma, is an interesting chapter. Before we make music, the music makes us. It's the title of his chapter. And he points out that one discovery that is perhaps an absolutely fantastic discovery is the discovery that the world presents itself to us as sound. And he quotes the director of the Max Planck Research Institute for Astrophysics, Rudolf Kippenhahn. And I'd just like to read this because I think it's an amazing sort of thing of what we have to listen to. Kippenhahn said, at a lecture I gave around 1960, I asked the audience to imagine an instrument capable of transforming all the incoming radiation from space into audible sound. We would hear the constant rushing of the starlight and the radio eruptions of the sun, as well as the rushing of the radio waves whose sources in space were known to us at that time, as they swelled and faded rhythmically with the rising and setting of these steadily radiating objects as they appeared to revolve around the Earth with the rest of the firmament. In fact, it would be a pretty boring affair. Today, 20 years later, he was speaking therefore in 1980, I must correct that picture. Besides the radiation we knew about back then, the auditory image of space we would receive today would be dominated by newly discovered sources. Now we would hear the heterodyne ticking of the pulsars, the low humming of the cancer pulsar, for instance. Sources of X radiation would fire their salvos. The source, MXB173335, for instance, emitting pulses of very high energy from a spherical star cluster, about a dozen pulses with breaks of 10 or 20 seconds between each one, to be discontinued then for minutes until a new sequence would be fired off again. There is not only rushing to be heard in space, there is ticking and drumming, humming and crackling. Probably the neutron stars are most responsible for this noise being transferred by our imaginary instrument from space to our ears. And then in their amateur radio astronomers notebook, Jeff Lichtman and Robert Sickles comment, "By the science of radio telescopy, a whole new dimension of the universe is revealed. The edge of the galaxy becomes a noisy, hissing cacophony of sound. These sounds being produced by quick shifts in molecular and atomic energy levels in gases made hot by newly born stars. The sun makes its noises too, hisses and crackling sounds when it is in a condition of relative quietude, and roars of alarming intensity when it becomes angry and spews giant portions of matter far out of space, far out into space." Now, one of the things that he points out in this, which is quite fascinating, is that it's not simply sound, but that the harmonics of it can actually be charted. And he gives indeed the harmonic correspondences, and he has pages on this, you see, which are both quantitative and qualitative, that it's not simply sound, but it is harmonic sound and follows a proportion. And he illustrates this, that it's governed by the laws of the golden section, which is, of course, the Pythagorean golden section. And so from that point of view, he goes into it. Incidentally, we will be having Cleve Baxter back here again next week. And Barrett points out plants can also hear and differentiate between various kinds of music and so on. And he talks about research going on in which listening to cells has shown that even a simple corn stalk has a sound. Recent research has also shown that plants in a meadow, field, or forest will wither if their vibrations, in other words, their sounds, relate disharmonically to other plants in the vicinity. So I call this to your attention because if you're at all interested in it, and he goes into the law of octaves and so on and quite some technicality. He also quotes, of course, Kandinsky. Many of you remember the exhibit on the spiritual and art, and Kandinsky very much influenced by theosophy, by H.P. Blavatsky's writings. And he quotes Kandinsky, the great Russian expressionist painter, whose Blauer Reiter Almanach spoke of a thorough base in a harmonology of painting, remarked, "The world sounds. It is a cosmos of spiritually effective beings." But as he points out, the cosmos, the universe, chooses from these billions of possibilities, that is, of vibration. There, from the standpoint of physics, there are billions of different possible vibrations. But the cosmos, the universe, chooses from these billions of possibilities with overwhelming preference for those few thousand vibrations that make harmonic sense. So, and he goes on to prove it. So I really think
Has any music been done from those things?
Yes, yes, indeed. Oh, yes, let me read you something along that line. That this is an article which appeared in a magazine, I've forgotten, I think it's New Realities magazine. The Greek ancient Pythagoras intuited a celestial harmony which he named the music of the spheres, and now modern genetic research has discovered musical genes. Genetic researcher Susumu Ono, a Japanese researcher, was struck by the flowing, repetitious nature of all genes in all creatures and decided to convert chemical formulas for living cells into musical notes. He discovered that genes carry a tune, not just random tones, but music structured very much like that of the Baroque and Romantic styles. Ono suggests that this genetic foundation offers a possible explanation for the origins of music. Certain melodies seem happy and others sad because we are genetically predisposed to hear them that way. Although genes are exceedingly complex chemically, they are composed of only four basic nucleic acids. To devise his musical gene system, Ono consigned two consecutive notes to each of the four chemicals, thereby making one octave of musical tones. His first composition was the mouse waltz, translated from a segment of mouse RNA. Ono says his work demonstrates the principle of periodicity, a theory which holds that the universe tends to move from chaos to order and back to chaos in certain common patterns. The patterns that govern the movement of planets and galaxies also appear in genes and in music. So, you see, when I ask you to consider how can I discover my own sound, you see, we have to begin to listen. And this, rather than producing sound, we have to begin to listen. To become fully awake, which is to see, we have to learn to hear. And so thou hast to hear the voice of thy inner God in seven manners. And I think that it's interesting that it uses the term, or HPB translated, in seven manners, because this means there is only one sound which can be heard in seven different manners, seven different ways, doesn't it? As I understand it. So there is only one, because the universe is one, we are one with it. This is the reality we have to come to. It's a non-dual system. The theosophical worldview is non-dual. So there is one sound, but we hear it in seven manners. These are, I suggest, the fields of our manifested existence. And to me, this is much more we can relate it to. Incidentally, I haven't talked about the whole philosophy of Sanskrit grammar, which the nada is indeed the four kinds of sound and so on. To make it up. Dr. Timney treats this, incidentally, in his little book on the Gayatri, which is a marvelous little work. But here we, I think, begin to recognize the ways in which we hear that one sound, the inner, thy inner God, that is the higher self, however you want to define it. She says, the first is like the nightingale's sweet voice chanting a song of parting to its mate. I equate this with the physical domain, because it's in that sweetness which is always parting, which is always the separation, where we are most aware of separation, which is the physical. Most aware of it. We see it. It's visible, isn't it? I'm obviously separate from this table, I'm separate from you, we're separate from each other. We're contained, as it were, in this carapace of flesh. Mm-hmm. So it seems to me that that, first of all, the nightingale's sweet voice, it's very sweet, it's enchanting, it has this quality, this song of parting, all the time separation. So I equate that with physical. The second comes as the sound of a silver cymbal of the Dhyanis awakening the twinkling stars. I equate this with prana. This is the sound of a silver cymbal of the Dhyanis awakening the twinkling stars, that it's a kind of it's the breath that's in and out. It's the pranic energy that is there. The next is as the plaint melodious of the ocean sprite imprisoned in its shell, which it seems to me equates then with the what I'm simply going to call the etheric. The ocean sprite imprisoned in its shell, which gives the form to the shell. Its very presence gives the form. So, and this is followed by the chant of Veena. Of course, the Veena is an Indian instrument, a musical instrument. I equate this with Kama, because that to me seems to be the element that the Veena. Would you describe the Veena, Rajapan? It's a
string instrument.
It's a string instrument, and it's plucked, isn't it? It's plucked. And it gives the note of
seven.
Yes.
Actually, this, I think in the ultimate analysis, these refer to the Sapta Swaras, we call it music.
Music.
Seven
yes.
notes.
The seven notes, yes. So I equate that with Kama. The bamboo flute. The fifth-like sound of bamboo flute shrills in thine ear. And that to me is manas.
Sorry.
Yes, it's through which, you know, and if the bamboo flute is blocked by all sorts of muddy stuff from below, the manas is not very clear. If it's clear, true manas, or the through it can sound the buddhi. It changes next into a trumpet blast. And that, I feel, is buddhi, because when often, of course, we think of buddhi as discriminative wisdom, as intuition, if you like, the creative potential. And I think it often hits us like a trumpet blast, you know, it just shakes us. So I equate it with that. The last vibrates like the dull rumbling of a thunder cloud. The seventh swallows all the other sounds. And so the thunder rumbling is, I suggest, Atman, which is, of course, encompasses all the others. So I merely suggest that. It's interesting, in the Tibetan Book of the Dead, there is the point at which one must hear the sound of the self as a thousand thunders roaring, so that it's the total sound that one must, in some sense, be willing to hear, to listen to. Well, how can I discover my own sound? And I put these two questions. What is the sound of silence? Having pointed out, as he does, that in fact he has a chapter, sound is more certain than time and matter. But how can we discover, what is the sound that you're making? John?
And this is where the question comes in the other day, is experience necessary?
Yes.
A personal story?
Yes.
About 40 years ago, I was riding on a bus in Washington, D.C., and I was sort of hanging on the strap and sleeping, almost asleep. And this voice of, like music, like the nightingale, was saying, there's no thing called nothing and nowhere called no. And so that sentence for me was like like Nightingale's song. And for 4 years, I have heard that song. It's like a music. It's like a theme. It's just like beautiful music. Mm-hmm. I can sleep, you know, I hear it. It's like an inner reality. But the idea of experience necessary to change in that, you know, midwinter snowstorm or riding on a bus, coming in like that, was the experience that will never be for me.
Yes.
So that's one example.
Yes. Very good.
What's his name? The Song of the Siren is a book by a doctor, somebody, I can't think of his name. But this is the idea in his book, too.
Mm-hmm.
The experience of seeing and hearing being one can sometimes be known looking at the canopy of stars at night, because if you're utterly alone and you're there with us, there does seem to be a tone.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't describe it as being able to hear it in your ears at all.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. This is true. But can we discover our own sound, our own note even?
Well, in music performance, you find that each person has their own sound. So if you would take five violinists, or any sort of players at all, we'll say violin for the sake of the argument, put five violins on the piano here, screen off this room, so that you will hear, and each person go in and play once, each taking a turn of one violin, you would hear five different people, five very distinct sounds.
That's interesting.
It's quite staggering.
That's amazing.
And so that you could always recognize, if you knew the person previously, you knew their musical performance, you would always recognize them by their sound. And in this way, if you think about it, we recognize singers on the radio, we listen and say, Sutherland, or Placido Domingo, or
we do, yes, we do, don't we?
We recognize their sound. Now, I suspect that our own, what we do with our speaking voices, too, once we get over various recognition things, a person, you can lift up a telephone, you can immediately know just by one sound
who it is.
So we already have these clues.
We do have. And I understand that a more accurate form of identification, for example, of criminals and so on, which is coming into widespread usage, is sound patterns rather than fingerprint patterns.
Is
that
popularized on
movies,
isn't it?
Yes, it is. Opens the door for them and so on. So we already have some clues, haven't we?
So perhaps this metaphor, or this observation, excuse me, can be used as a metaphor to extend our whole nature, not just the way a physical body produces sounds. But for me, metaphor is the way through this door. And before that, you need stillness. You need to be personally and inwardly still, I think, before you can begin to be active here.
When you're still, when everyone is still, you can hear the sound driven by the rushing of blood through your system. It's very quiet.
Yes.
If you do an ohm sound and close off your ears, you hear something besides the ohm sound. This is a technique that we've taught.
Yes.
If we could watch our line of music, I believe we would learn to assess sound. Because I believe I've caught my voice becoming harsh when I have let go of watching the motive of the line.
Yes.
It's really true. Some people have beautiful voice qualities because of the way they live their lives.
Yes. It's true. Nancy?
Of your relationships, that what the people that you interact with and the type of interactions probably tells you a lot about you and the sound.
It does. You see, we have a physical sound. Certainly, we have an emotional sound. We have a mental sound. What do our minds sound like? You know, you can sit next to someone and feel that their mental emotional sound is so strong that it's jarring, it's not harmonious, isn't it? Or you can sit next to someone whose mental emotional sound immediately quiets you down and you come into harmony with that person.
I think in Rohit Mehta's book, he said we get 10,000 impressions every second, and so I feel so that every once in a while I'm in chaos.
Yes. But to discover, you see, what sound are we making as we go through the world? Can we say even what is the sound of silence? I put that on as a second one because is there a sound to silence?
Is there a silence in the sound?
Uh-huh. All right.
Because I don't think that from my intuitive understanding and my personal experience, I don't think there is ever silence.
There can't ever be silence.
I've never heard silence.
So is there what is the silence in sound? Interesting to consider.
Talking about sound, it is really vibrations too, so I think you're pushing it deeper. You're talking about the energy of the vibration, really.
Mm-hmm.
But beyond what I do is actually.
Mm-hmm.
About sound being the veil of silence.
Perhaps sound is the veil of silence.
Mm-hmm. And in the physical realm, empty space, even perfect background. I think we touched on this subject a bit last night, that it is actually a squirming field of potentiality out of which particles are forever momentary appearing in a simple background of that sea. And so perhaps that energy, that constantly active sea of
is the sound of silence in the physical world. Mm-hmm. By analogy, we can go to that one. Well, we went into one of the caves, and the leader asked the group to be totally quiet. They turned off the lights, what little lights there were, and to be totally quiet. For, I don't know, it was a minute, 30 seconds, whatever. And this group cooperated. And there is something in silence. I can't define it.
Mm-hmm.
But this was a physical thing. It was dark, and there was nothing. And there was something there. But I don't consider it a spiritual experience. It was just something that we did under the conditions that I explained. Darkness and other silence.
It would be like a reflexive quality when you try to contemplate and listen to the sound of silence. The deeper you try to penetrate the silence, the more you tend to be brought back into your own consciousness.
Mm-hmm. 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 There's a Zen koan. If you blot out sense and sound, what do you hear?
Space between her stars.
There's a wonderful Chinese story that a Chinese hermit named Ru was able to pierce clouds and crack large boulders with his flute playing. But even such flute playing produced only audible tones. Only when this flute was blown in the reverse direction would it tear apart the void with its inaudible sound. Mm-hmm. There's a passage also that he quotes from Hesse's marvelous work, Siddhartha, which I suspect many of us have read. Wonderful book. Let me just read this excerpt from Siddhartha. Siddhartha stayed with the ferryman and learned how to look after the boat. And when there was nothing to do at the ferry, he worked in the rice field with Vasudeva, gathered wood and picked fruit from the banana trees. He learned how to make oars, how to improve the boat and to make baskets. He was pleased with everything that he did and learned, and the days and months passed quickly. He once asked the ferryman, "Have you also learned that secret from the river, that there is no such thing as time?" "Yes, Siddhartha," he said, "is this what you mean? That the river is everywhere at the same time, at the source and at the mouth, at the waterfall, at the ferry, at the current, in the ocean and in the mountains, everywhere, and that the present only exists for it, not the shadow of the past nor the shadow of the future?" "That is it," said Siddhartha. "And when I learned that, I reviewed my life, and it was also a river. And Siddhartha the boy, Siddhartha the mature man, and Siddhartha the old man were only separated by shadows, not through reality. Siddhartha's previous lives were also not in the past, and his death and his return to Brahma were not in the future. Nothing was, nothing will be. Everything has reality and presence." And once again, when the river swelled during the rainy season and roared loudly, Siddhartha said, "Is it not true, my friend, that the river has very many voices?" "It is so," nodded Vasudeva. "The voices of all living creatures are in its voice." "And do you know," continued Siddhartha, "what word it pronounces when one is successful in hearing all its 10,000 voices at the same time?" Vasudeva laughed joyously. He bent towards Siddhartha and whispered the holy Om in his ear. And this is just what Siddhartha had heard. Can we, through all the 10,000, can we hear the 10,000 voices at the same time and hear only one note, which is the note of unity, the note of creative unity? Well, I don't want to carry this on unless there's something you'd like to discuss about it.
Wondering about the system of the mantras that are given for meditation, because they are basically sound.
Yes, they are.
Mm-hmm. And the explanation I have heard of a teacher giving a specific mantra to a specific student, mm-hmm. is that it is meant to be the sound that will lead that student's mind into the depths of that person.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, court is centered toward that third hall.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what that sound is meant to do, is to attract the mind toward that level.
That's right.
So it's not meant to distract the mind or subdue it, but to lead it, to entice it, so to speak,
mm-hmm.
to lead it on through the pleasantness of the sound that it's engineered for the individual and leads the individual to his own inner self.
Mm-hmm. He has a chapter, "Not a Brahma as Koan and as Mantra." And he quotes Vilayat Inayat Khan, "In the mantram practices, one actually kneads the very flesh of our body with sound." K-N-E-A-D, the kneading of bread. "And the delicate cells of these elaborate bundles of nerve fibers that are the plexi or ganglia are subjected to a consistent hammering. There is a kind of seizure of the flesh by the vibrations of sound."
Mm-hmm. The cities are getting involved, those.
Yes, of course. The hammerings. But of course, as we know too, the name, our names have magic. And in some cultures, of course, the name is very sacred, and the name is not really pronounced. And you're given another name. What is the true name of the self? To sound that name, which is a kind of mantra. Well, no other comments. We'll adjourn a little early today, I guess. But Monday then, we'll take up the two paths. And I hope that this has led you into consideration of what are the sounds that we make as we move through the world? What sound do we make? Do we rustle and bustle, and do we, you know, create confusion as we move through the world? Or, and what sounds do we choose to receive? Yes.
What sounds do we glorify, or what sounds do we vilify?
That's right, yes.
And so is it.
And you know what, there are studies, I was just reading in Brain Mind Bulletin, there are studies with children on if sound is presented to the right ear for right-handed children, but sound presented to the alternate ear can indeed, I think, increase learning. But if it's presented to the same ear, it frequently decreases the learning skills. I think you may have read that too, Nancy. Very interesting, because there are so many young people today that can't do their homework, it seems to me, without music blaring. Horrible, my estimation, often horrible music blaring at them. But it's interesting that there are studies going on with regard to the bringing about of the awakening the other hemisphere of the brain, as it were, through music. Is it the right hemisphere that is the...
If anybody would want to play with sound, there's a way of working with your own sound, which is as you exhale your breath and just make that a little louder, you have mm-hmm. your own sound. And if you just breathe that way, making a tone, it really acts like an internal massage. It's very, very balancing. Mm-hmm. It's used a lot with healing.
With healing, yes.
But it's something that, you know, you can lay down at night and really do it to yourself. It's, mm-hmm. it's a very relaxing. Mm-hmm. I don't yes. think we use our voices for words, mm-hmm. but we don't use our voices for our sound.
For our sound, yes. So, you know, what I'm talking about is not touching on the lower siddhis or the psychic, but rather really listening to that interior, you know, to align ourselves, to really align ourselves so that there is that sounding which is the encompassing sound, the one that encompasses the all. Okay.